I remember having discussions with companies saying, hey, you know, in a couple of years, we're going to be producing 10 million tons of DDG. What are we going to do with all that? We're going to have to burn it and landfill it. There's no way that we can use 10 million tons in the U.S. Well, you know, we're right now sitting about 33 to 35 million tons per year, and we're not landfilling it and we're not burning it. We're using it in beef and dairy and swine and poultry, and we're using it in fish. We're using it in pet foods. We're exporting about a third of it. You know, I have to say, you know, it's thanks to nutritionists like yourself and others that have really been at the leading edge of how do we not just maximize, but how do we optimize the use of DDG and other ingredients.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Did you know that beta-carotene deficiency can affect fertility rates and reproductive performance? Victus Transition from DSM Firmenich provides beta-carotene to help your cattle fertility rates.
With early detection in health, reproduction, and feeding, SmaxTech future-proofs your dairy operation. Excellent, a novel product for the management of hypocalcemia. It's uncomplicated excellence. Priority IAC, the only company bringing the fields of microbiology and nutrition together. Adiseo USA, producers of SmartAmine M and MilkPay.com.
Lalamond Animal Nutrition, partnering in microbial solutions for a changing world.
Hello, welcome back to the Dairy Podcast Show brought to you by Wisenetics. My name is Barry Bradford from Michigan State University. Today, I'm very pleased to welcome to the show Dr. Kurt Rosentrater, who's a professor at Iowa State University. Kurt, thanks for joining today.
Thank you so much, Barry. I appreciate the opportunity to share some thoughts and as it relates specifically to the dairy industry and to agriculture in general.
It's always fun to talk to a fellow cyclone, but you're in both the Department of Ag and Biosystems Engineering and the Department of Food Science and Human Nutrition. Can you explain to us a little bit about your focus, your background, your expertise?
So I grew up in Iowa on a traditional corn and soybean farm. We also had beef and swine herds and did farrow to finish. So we had cow-calf operation. And you know, from a young age, I knew that I wanted to be a farmer. And unfortunately, when I was in high school, I was informed that, you know, you got to figure out something to do with your life because you can't be a farmer. So I came to Iowa State and, you know, started out in biochemistry. And I have to say thanks to Don Bites for introducing me to biochemistry. But I realized that chemistry was hard and biology was hard, and I didn't know what I wanted to do. And so I stumbled to some other majors and finally landed in agricultural and biosystems engineering, and then found a way to join the idea of math and science to agriculture. And ironically, what I focused on was processing of cereals. And there's a lot of biochemistry involved. So I actually kind of come full circle and I do a lot of biochemistry again.
I was going to say, you tried to find a less rigorous major and you ended up in engineering. This doesn't sound very logical.
No. In retrospect, I ended up in the same place. So
yeah, that's really neat. And then so where did your career take you then after you finished up at Iowa State?
When I finished my undergraduate, I decided that I really wanted to dig in more and learn more. And so I stayed for my master's, I stayed for my PhD, and both of those were in agricultural and biosystems engineering with a focus in food process engineering. And after I finished, I decided, you know, I'm going to try to work in industry for a while. So I worked at an engineering company where I was lucky enough to learn how to design processing facilities, grain elevators, feed mills, flour mills, pet food plants, biodiesel plants. And I actually left before the ethanol boom started. So I stayed, I would have been designing ethanol plants. But I decided I had a PhD. I wanted to try being a teacher for a while. So I moved to the Chicago suburbs, which is completely different from where I grew up in Iowa, Northern Illinois University for a few years. And one of my PhD committee members had left Iowa State, gone to Kansas State, and then left Kansas State and went to USDA Ag Research Service, ARS. And he was just outside of Philadelphia. And he was telling me about a really interesting opportunity as a process engineering scientist, focusing on corn ethanol processing. And my spouse and I decided Philadelphia was a little too far away from family. We had young kids at the time. But hey, there was an opening in Brookings, South Dakota, almost exactly the same type of research program. And so we moved to Brookings and we spent quite a few years in Brookings. And it was really interesting because it was working on questions directly related to corn farmers, soybean farmers, but also the corn ethanol industry and problems and challenges that the ethanol industry was having. And so to see an industry grow and to actually do research that industry was using, that was really a lot of fun. But I've been at Iowa State now for over a decade. Iowa State called me up and said, hey, we've got an opening. We need someone to work on biofuels and processing and cost assessment and environmental assessment. And you fit exactly what we're looking for in terms of the bioeconomy. And so that's what brought me back to Iowa State. And, you know, the questions that drive me are, how do we sustainably produce commodities and for consumers? And how do we solve problems to make the production process, whether it's on a farm or in a factory, how do we make them more efficient and cost effective?
Schooler provides high quality feed solutions you can always count on. Offering a diverse portfolio of ingredients for all stages of the life cycle, they are a trusted partner for dairies. From bulk feed grains to plant-based proteins and energy-dense distillers grains, find what you need to support your herd's growth and well-being at schooler.com/dairy. That's schooler.com/dairy.
It's pretty neat. Yeah, you've been in the middle of some pretty huge shifts, right, in development of the ethanol industry and such. You were involved in that. You weren't necessarily in the middle of companies doing it, but you were doing research and partnering with them. Walk us through what that looked like from like sort of the first commercial scale ethanol plants generating ethanol. And I guess just saying, oh, we have this leftover feed here. What are we going to do with this? To that being really a co-product today.
You know, it's such an interesting question, Barry, because, you know, back in the old days, okay, 20 years ago, isn't really the old days. But this was, I remember having discussions with companies saying, hey, you know, in a couple of years, we're going to be producing 10 million tons of DDG. What are we going to do with all that? We're going to have to burn it and landfill it. There's no way that we can use 10 million tons in the U.S. Well, you know, we're right now sitting about 33 to 35 million tons per year, and we're not landfilling it and we're not burning it. We're using it in beef and dairy and swine and poultry, and we're using it in fish. We're using it in pet foods. We're exporting about a third of it. You know, I have to say, you know, it's thanks to nutritionists like yourself and others that have really been at the leading edge of how do we not just maximize, but how do we optimize the use of DDG and other ingredients for a variety of species. And it was interesting. Someone asked me once upon a time, because when I was in Brookings, I did a lot of collaborative work with nutritionists at South Dakota State, and, you know, the beef and dairy and the swine folks. But we also did fish work as well. And how do the fish like all that fiber? Well, okay, you know, you don't feed just DDG, you don't feed just soybean meal. It's part of a mixture. So how do you optimize that use in a blend for different species and different age groups? And so it was a really interesting time because it was really collaborative between the federal government, between universities, between private companies, you know, really trying to answer the question, how do we best use this product and continue to build new factories that's going to bring more of this product online? And it was such an evolution from this idea of we make alcohol and, oh, by the way, we have this other stuff that we need to get rid of. You know, time and again, we had those discussions like, wait a minute, you have protein, you have lipids, you have fiber, you have minerals. It's not just stuff to get rid of. And so really, it took a long time for everyone involved in the science to show what is the value of DDG, the value of DDGS. And I think it's really a testament to all of the scientists involved that, hey, we can use a lot of DDG in a ration. But, you know, the challenge, of course, as you know, how does that price out compared to competing ingredients? And with DDG, the two primary competing ingredients are soybean meal and corn. Those are the two primary competitors. And DDG or DDGS tracks very closely, parallels very closely the price of corn. Now, if we can increase the value of the DDG, absolutely we can increase the value to the ethanol plants and the value to the corn farmers. But the livestock producers are going to be the ones that have to make up that difference. So, you know, there's no magic bullet in the feed industry, as you know. So how do we do our best to make good decisions that are going to provide the biggest benefit to the not just the farmers, but also the livestock producers and the ethanol plants?
The whole system, right? Yeah. I remember some like big scale analyses kind of attacking the biofuel space 15 years ago. And I remember reading one in particular that claimed that there was a negative energy return on the investment. But when you dug in the details, they basically completely discounted the energy or, the, you know, whatever nutrient you're looking at, energy in this case, from DDGs. And they said, oh, basically it should just be spread back on the fields to return nutrients. And it's like, that doesn't make a lot of sense to me. Like, you can run it through an animal and still return a lot of the nutrients back to the field. So I think, I don't know, what's your, you've studied that way more than me. I do think the DDGs, how they're used, is a huge impact on the net benefit of that whole system, right, to the economy as a whole.
You know, it's so interesting because in the last 3, 4, 5 years, there's been a big push amongst lots of different organizations, the idea of the circular economy. And, you know, for me, I laugh at that because in agriculture, we've been doing a circular economy for generations. And, you know, whether it's soybean meal or DDG or bakery waste or candy waste, we use these materials. We upcycle what we don't use for our primary production in animals to make meat, milk, and eggs. So we've been doing this idea of the circular economy for a long time. I think the challenge we have as scientists is how do we provide the biggest net benefit? Because you're right, we can't discount what is the, not just the economic value of the byproducts or the co-products, but, you know, when companies are doing their life cycle assessments or their other assessments, we have to include what is the actual energy content or the carbon content of the co-products as well. And it's interesting because the naysayers are still at it. You know, the players have changed. You know, Pimental died a few years ago. He was probably the leading person in terms of anti-ethanol. But there are still other people who are beating that drum. And it's incumbent upon us, I think, to continue to show that there is a positive value for whatever industry we're talking about, especially you can't discount the co-products.
So I know even as a nutritionist, I've seen sort of the back end of this, but there's been an evolution in terms of shifting processes, I guess, to generate ethanol. And that's in some cases, I believe, specifically designed to generate a higher value co-product. So we have distillers grains now with varying levels of fat content and maybe some other sort of niche markets or I don't want know how to say it, so sort of higher value DDGs out there. I don't know how much you've tracked that or seen some of those innovations on the processing side. How would you think about that today if you're running a dairy and thinking about ingredients for the herd?
You know, that's a really interesting question too, because it was maybe about 15 years ago, someone who wasn't involved in the ethanol industry really asked me, isn't it about time to start researching something else? Haven't you all done everything that needs to be done? Don't you all know everything that there is to know on DDG? Like, not even close. The industry is so dynamic. There's so many changes. And, you know, it's a whole suite of things that the ethanol industry really has been focusing on over the last couple of decades. You know, the first, you know, from about 2002 to maybe 2010, more or less, the industry was focused on building new facilities. But then as the quantity of ethanol was reaching what the federal mandate called for, then the competition was more strict, and it became important to focus on efficiency of production, and because of costs, the margins became really quite narrow. And so about 2010, 2011, we really started seeing companies start installing centrifuges to remove corn oil or distiller's oil. And that was part of the story of efficiency and expanding the portfolio of products that are available. And the first couple of years, operational efficiencies weren't so great. And there were a lot of different players in the market. But, you know, it took a couple of years, but efficiencies they've improved. And so consistency of production, which is important for nutritionists. Consistency of the oil separation and consistency of the fat content of the distiller's products has really been really good for the last decade. But then, okay, margins are still tight. What else can the ethanol companies do to become more efficient, to become more competitive? And there have been lots of different attempts to do clean fractionation. How do you cleanly separate the lipids from the protein, from the fiber? And DDG is not necessarily easy to separate these nutrient components. And so what a lot of companies have been focusing on, you know, you can separate, or maybe concentrate is a better word, protein from fiber from oil in the DDG itself. But it's the particles are glued together in the dryers, and so it's more difficult to do, and the efficiency of the separation is not so clean. Well, go to the front end and do degermination and then the oil extraction out of the germ, and then you can do a dry fractionation of the fiber from the starch, and it's expensive to do. We don't have a lot of dry mill corn fractionation plants in the U.S. We have a handful, but not a lot. It's expensive. And so what we've seen over the last 7 to 8 years really has been a variety of technologies trying to separate the corn proteins from the lipids, from the fiber particles in the liquid phase before the dryers. So after fermentation, but before the dryers. And there's a handful of companies who are being very successful at that. It's not a small investment. So there are, you know, about a dozen of the ethanol plants that have installed these types of fractionation systems or separation systems. And there are more that are coming. And it's not just here in the U.S. We see this happening in Europe. We see this happening in Brazil. It's been kind of a slow ramp up because it's a significant investment. And, you know, multiple million dollars for what they call a bolt-on type of facility. But it's not really. It's an entirely separate process building where you basically use different components from the corn wet milling industry to fractionate. And it's not a clean fractionation. It is like you would see in a wet mill. It is a concentration of protein. It's a concentration of fiber. But then it is a clean separation of the oil because they're still using the centrifuges. So what I see happening in the marketplace, there are a handful of companies who are producing different variants on high protein products that technically don't fall under the AFCO definition of DDG anymore or DDGS. And so some companies are calling them corn fermented proteins mechanically extracted. So there are a variety of names to separate this product from a traditional DDGS. Now, as a scientist, as a nutritionist, we have to ask the question, okay, this company has this high protein product. This company has this high protein product. What do I use? And how do I use it? And what's it going to cost? And is there going to be any economic benefit for me to use this? And it's, you know, I think back 20 years ago when so many universities were doing the nutrition work, the beef scientists, the dairy scientists, the poultry scientists, the fish, the pet food scientists. I mean, it was a huge contingent of people across the U.S. working and trying to answer these questions. We haven't really seen that en masse approach. We've seen the technology companies who are interested in selling their technology. We've seen them doing a handful of feeding trials, but I contend that there's still a lot of work that needs to be done to understand how do I use this high protein product or this high fiber product? How do I use it in a lactating dairy ration? How do I use it in a dry cow ration? How do I use it for my grower finishers if I'm talking pigs? You know, how do I use it for this species of this age group? There's a lot of work that needs to be done.
One thing that I think is kind of interesting, I'm pretty sure this is true, that I think a lot of those higher value concentrated corn protein sources are actually reaching farms in a commercial protein blend that feed companies are buying that, and then they're incorporating other protein sources to come up with an amino acid profile that's good for a lactating cow, and which is fine. The downside of that is, other than studying that branded product, right, we don't make a lot of progress on, you know, the source ingredient, their particular digestibility, the rumen bypass value, those sorts of things. So
exactly. And, you know, corn is deficient in lysine. DDGS is deficient in lysine. And these high protein corn-based products are also deficient in lysine. So it's just because you're increasing protein content, are you improving the protein profile? Now, some companies will contend that yeast protein is augmenting that amino acid profile. But it's, like I said earlier, there's no silver bullet. There's still a lot of research that needs to be done to understand how do I best use this for my specific application.
Absolutely. So that kind of leads naturally into the question of thinking about cost comparisons, trade-offs between using distillers grains versus soybean meal. How do you approach that question?
Historically, it's been an easy question to ask, historically, but that's changing. Historically, soybean meal has been priced more or less about 80 to 100% higher than the price of DDGS or DDG. And they are direct competitors. And for a while, there was more DDGS produced in the U.S. than there was soybean meal. But that's changing now. And so soybean meal is the number one ingredient produced by volume in the U.S. again. But what I have seen is that soybean meal and DDGS are very complementary materials. And especially in terms of the nutrient balances and digestibilities. So part of our story in terms of pricing is the export market, and part of it is the internal market. So historically, if you say the price of DDG for years was about $120 a metric ton, and then over the last decade, that's almost doubled. But when countries like China, for example, have gone into the DDG market, they buy a lot of DDGS. When they exit the market, I mean, we are talking a few hundred dollars per metric ton price swings within a week. So If you go up to over $400 a ton to less than $200 a ton in a week because one country is either importing or not importing, thinking about getting outside the box and doing something to improve the value of your co-product is really important. But you have to overcome that plus minus $100 to $200 per metric ton price swing. So what is the economic value of these high protein products? Well, it depends. You know, what are we comparing it against? Are we comparing it against soybean meal? Are we comparing it against soy protein concentrate? It's hard to say that it's an apples to apples comparison because the nutrient balances are different and the digestibilities are different. But what I see is, okay, the old paradigm of $120 to $150 per metric ton for DDGS, yeah, that's not where it is anymore. That has shifted upward because of global demand. And if we didn't have global demand for the DDGS, it would still probably be about $120 to $150 per metric ton. But there's global demand. And I have to say, as companies and organizations in the U.S. have done a really good job of showing the value of DDGS to livestock industries globally. And so there is that demand for our export market, which is great. It supports the corn farmers. It supports the ethanol industry. But it's also important that the industries, whether they're producing a high-protein product or a traditional product, not every ethanol company is going to produce a high-protein product. I mean, there is value in maintaining the relationships with your local farmers, your local producers, the social aspect, if you will, you know, maintaining those relationships and the consistent supply. But for some companies, it makes total sense to target the export markets. But there is still going to be a need for traditional DDGS. That is not going to go away. Not every ethanol company is going to install this technology. So what is the value of the new protein products? Is it equivalent to the value of soybean meal? Is it equivalent to the value of soy protein concentrate? Obviously, companies want to sell their product for as much as the producers or importers are willing to pay, right? So I still contend that we need to do more research trials to understand the efficacy of these products. And is it sufficient to say that my feed ingredient that I'm producing produces equivalent performance to a soybean meal based diet or a DDGS based diet as your primary ingredient? Or do you want to show an increased benefit? Do you want to show an increased feed conversion? Do you want to show a reduced total feed cost? I think that's where we have to go and not do an equivalency, but a benefit.
Yeah, and it's obviously easier to say, oh, here's the relative price, the value of those two ingredients. But the reality is its value in a specific diet depends on what else you're feeding, right? And that depends on where you're at and what your relative costs are for different ingredients at that place. And so,
yeah, it's like large poultry integrators. You know, sometimes they use DDGS and sometimes they don't. They know how to use it. It just doesn't price in or not compared to the competing ingredients. And I would say our challenge as an ethanol industry and as a livestock industry and a dairy industry, our challenge is that we have so many challenges every year. They change, but they don't change. You know, how do we make profits? And, you know, given the economic and political realities in this country and other countries, what about the new soybean processing plants that have been coming online in the few years? You know, soybean meal is growing in, soybean oil is growing in prevalence. So, you know, what's that going to do to the price of soy products? And what's that going to do to the price of corn products? But, you know, someone told me recently that if all of the soy crush plants go online that are supposed to go online, we will no longer be able to supply the world market with soybeans for export. You know, will that actually happen? I don't know. That would be an interesting problem to have. But then it's not just the soy plants. It's also the sustainable aviation fuel plants that some will be based on soy potentially, some will be based on corn potentially. So if those come to fruition, then maybe we'll use all of our corn and soy. Wouldn't that be a great problem to have? That would be a really good problem to have. I don't know if we'll ever get there. I mean, the political reality is, what is the continued support for biofuels going to be, especially on the sustainable aviation fuel side?
So it's currently, most of our soy exports are in the form of whole beans. Is that correct?
Whole beans, but also soybean meal.
Okay, both. Okay.
It's hard to compete with the efficiency of Brazil and Argentina.
It's time for our famous three.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Our Yeast 40 ruminal and intestinal double modulation by ICC Animal Nutrition. Feed solutions that surpass expectations. Learn more about the benefits of working with Schooler. Visit schooler.com/feed. That's schooler.com/feed. Natural Biologics delivers cost-effective solutions to improve health and productivity, helping conquer the rumen health and immunity challenges your animals face. Your partner for extra animal performance, Berg & Schmidt Animal Nutrition.
Modern solutions for modern cows with AHV. Contact us to beat biofilm-related issues in your herd.
Typical fresh cow incidence of clinical hypocalcemia is 3 to 6%. While subclinical hypocalcemia affects 50% or more mature cows. Based on cutting-edge research, Exelite offers a new approach that is build effective and the ZDUs. For more information, visit www.protecta.com.
Okay, great conversation. We've got to the time now where we've got to throw our three famous questions at you. And you work across species, which is cool, so feel free to insert different terms in here if you want. But first question we ask people, what's your favorite dairy-related book or resource?
Can I expand beyond just dairy alone? Because I've got a lot of books in my personal library, but one that I have found recently called Dispatches from Farm Country. So, I don't know if you've heard of this one or not, but it was written last year by a reporter that traveled around the U.S. and met with a variety of farmers and to understand what is the underlying spirit of the American farmer. And so I'm not all the way through the book yet, but I find it really insightful because, you know, that the idea of producing food for people, but also the tie to the land. How do you explain that? You know, did you grow up on a farm?
I did. Yep.
And I did as well. It, to try to explain that, to that feeling, that desire, that identity.
Yeah.
It's hard to do, but this reporter tries to do that. Dispatches from Farm Country by Jim Patrico.
And I like that cover photo. It looks like it could be from, you know, the Yellowstone TV series, except there's all the wind turbines, right? It's a nice...
Hey, it'll be interesting to see what Taylor Sheridan comes up with for a follow-on series. I hear rumors that there's another one in the works, but...
Is that right? All right. What about your favorite book outside of agriculture?
So I was introduced to this author when I lived in South Dakota. I was thinking about this question. You know, who is my favorite author or favorite book, one that I go back to time and again? The author's name is Badger Clark. I don't know if you've ever heard of Badger Clark. So he was a cowboy poet about 100 years ago. He had a cabin in the Black Hills in the National Forest, and he wrote poetry about living in rural America and living in the Black Hills. And you may have heard the Cowboy Prayer. That is probably his most famous piece.
Oh, he wrote that. Okay.
Yeah. So the primary compilation is called Sun and Saddle Leather. So That's probably my go-to book.
All right, last question. In your opinion, what sets successful professionals apart from those who are less successful?
That's always a tricky question. And something that's been on my mind the last few years, and I know I've said this before, if any of you listening to this podcast have seen any of my interviews before, my apologies, I'm going to say the same thing that I said last year. Gumption and grit. You got to be a self-starter and you got to see it through. I know a lot of people who have great ideas that never get started, or they get started and they never finish. So I would say gumption and grit for me are the two key words that that I think about a lot in terms of how do you be a successful human? Being a human is hard. How do you be a successful researcher or scientist? It's hard. How do you be a successful farmer or livestock producer? It's hard. But those are the two words that I keep coming back to.
Fighting through weather, fighting through finances, right? You got to keep after it. That's good.
Absolutely.
Well, Dr. Rosentrader, thanks again for the conversation. This has been a lot of fun.
Me also. Thank you very much. You please invite me back anytime.
That'd be great. Well, this has been another episode of the Dairy Podcast Show, brought to you by Wisenetics. And if you haven't followed the show, make sure you hit the button so you don't miss the next episode. And we will see you then.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.